Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name is Lane Davis, and today I have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Arlen Migliazzo, Professor Emeritus of History at Whitworth University, and the author of Mother of Modern Evangelicalism, The Life and Legacy of Henrietta Mears, published in November of 2020 by Eerdmans Publishing Company as a part of their Library of Religious Biography series. Dr. Migliazzo, congratulations on the book and welcome to New Books in History.
Thank you, Lane.
Well, I think the first question that we have to start off with is, who was Henrietta Mears and what led you to write this book about her?
Oh, great opening. Yeah. Henrietta Mears, I never met her, but I kind of bumped into her through much of my kind of formative years. I'm an old broken down youth director, and I served my home church is in Compton, California, old United Presbyterian Church. And that's where I first heard about her. And then I came up to Washington State as a 21-year-old to do a summer youth work in the Yakima Valley. And I was involved with a group of other folks who were doing similar things in other Presbyterian Reformed churches, you know, in the region. And we read a biography of her, and this is back in, 73, I think, so it's going back a ways. But I read the biography, and then I kind of put it aside, and I got my doctorate and was starting to teach and all, I kind of put that aside, and again, an interest area, but something that I thought, well, maybe at some point I'll do some work on her. Did some other things, and it's about 14 years ago now. I ran into an article on her, and I kept the article. It was in a renewal kind of magazine that came out from the Presbyterian Church, and one of her former proteges wrote a piece about her, and I thought, that's intriguing. So I put it aside, put it kind of in my little reading basket, and then kind of left it there for 2 or 3 years. And then after I'd finished another book length project, I happened to pull it out and said, I should start to work on her a little bit. So that's kind of how that started. And she intrigued me because, again, born in 1890, the same year as Amy Semple McPherson, you know, the head of the International Church of the Four Square Gospel. Mm-hmm. She was born in the upper Midwest and to a family who had initially some fairly substantial resources. Her father was a financier, kind of a land developer kind of guy, but then had some pretty severe financial reverses and they moved 6 or 7 times before she was actually even in third or fourth grade. So had kind of not tumultuous, but a pretty difficult childhood, had some physical problems. And then as she grew to adulthood, she went to the University of Minnesota and got her degree in chemistry and became a teacher, taught in a couple of rural schools, one in extreme eastern Minnesota and the other one in extreme western Minnesota, and then was involved in Minneapolis teaching at actually her old high school for about 10 years. And while she was doing that, she was also a member of William Riley's First Baptist Church of Minneapolis, which of course was a major center of the fundamentalist movement back in the teens and the 20s. And so she was raised in that kind of environment. She took over in 1917 a girls' Sunday school class. Actually, it's kind of a young women's Sunday school class. There were just a handful of girls in that class initially. Within about 7 years, she had built it to the highest, Sunday school class that had the highest enrollment at Riley's church. It eventually peaked at about 450 young women. A number of those women went into mission service and lay leadership positions. And in the early 20s, she was invited to come to the First Presbyterian Church of Hollywood, California, and become the director of Christian education there. And so she left in 28 and served at that church until her death in 1963 and built it into purportedly the largest Sunday school in the Presbyterian Church and one of the 10 largest Sunday schools in all the United States. So while she was there, the church was always, and education was always kind of the focus for her. But in trying to build a better Sunday school, she also did a number of other things. She, for example, started a publishing company when she couldn't find Sunday school materials for her students that she thought passed muster. So she started the Gospelite Press, and that became one of the four largest independent religious publishing companies in the entire country. But that all started because she wanted her students to have good, solid Sunday school materials that were biblically based. So that became an issue that went well beyond the bounds of First Presbyterian Church. She also believed very much in developing retreats for her students where they could come away for an extended period of time and kind of just concentrate on Christian growth, biblical literacy, and those sorts of things. And that led in 1938 to the founding of the Forest Home Christian Conference Center, which today hosts upwards of 65,000 people a year there at multiple sites there in Southern California. She became a mentor to many, many folks in the, we would call it the kind of new evangelical wing of the church that begins really to be recognized in the 1940s, although she had been doing some of the same things that these neo-evangelicals were doing in the 40s and 50s back in the teens and the 20s. She became really involved in the National Association of Evangelicals. She mentored people like, Jim Rayburn, who was the head of Young Life International. He was one of her proteges. Bill Bright, who founded Campus Crusade for Christ, lived with her. He and his wife lived with her for almost 10 years, right across the street from UCLA. And the ministry of Campus Crusade for Christ came out of her influence. Billy Graham was very deeply influenced by Mears. Right before the big campaign in 1949 in LA, which really caused him to become a leader in this evangelical movement. He had spent a week at Forest Home with Henrietta Mears and really had a crisis of faith there that she helped him work through. She was involved in a number of organizations over the years and sent, I don't think anyone can really know how many missionaries or pastors that trained under her leadership. The round figure is often given to be 400. And in the book, I list as many as I could find. And there are a lot of them, but I'm not sure that's even all of them because the ones that I found were only folks that were involved in Reformed churches. And of course, she influenced a lot of folks in Baptist circles and in other denominations. And there's no way to kind of know how many of those folks she influenced. So she had a wide ranging influence over 40 years, probably close to 50 years. If we take her years of ministry in Minneapolis, as well as her years in the LA area.
Well, your book is certainly bringing some much needed attention to her influence. So you've mentioned some of the major points of the book. Let's kind of walk back through some of that chronology. So you noted as a young person that Mears joined the First Baptist Church in Minneapolis, which, as you noted, was led by William Bell Riley. And this was in the first decade of the 20th century as that fundamentalist and modernist controversy was really starting to heat up. Now, the title of your book places Mears as a catalyst figure for modern evangelicalism. So I guess discuss what you mean by that and how the background at Riley's church really shaped her theological trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, again, there's of course, a raging controversy over what evangelicalism or modern evangelicalism looks like. And in the book, I try to make the argument that it has less to do with theology and a lot more to do with kind of an approach to contemporary culture, the life of the mind, and those sorts of things. So what I think Mears was really influential in is maintaining a very strong sense of biblical orthodoxy. I mean, again, if you look at evangelicals, modern evangelicals, and you look at fundamentalists of the teens and 20s and such, you'll find that theologically they have an awful lot in common. You know, the personal work of Christ, the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, the importance of the Bible as the final authority in issues of faith and life. These kinds of major doctrines are shared by fundamentalists and these modern evangelicals. And I think that's where, I think her years as a young adult in Riley's church, again, she grew up in that church. She, again, became a member before she was 10 years old of that church. But then when she went away to college, to the university, and again, did some teaching outside of the Minneapolis area, that's where I think she made that kind of fundamentalist approach to life. That's where she made the kind of distinction in her own life, because she was a person that believed very much that, you know, you have to nurture the life of the mind. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of modern evangelicalism, certainly back in the 40s when it first began to develop, I think, in the country. She always believed in that. I mean, this woman was a chemistry major when women were not really, that was not an area that women really occupied very much in the university. She believed very much that you had to nurture the life of the mind. And I think fundamentalists, and Riley is a great example of this, because he had a crusade against the University of Minnesota, which of course was her alma mater. And I think she really parted company with him there. She believed that, you know, Christ could answer all the questions that we have as believers, and you didn't have to fear that. You didn't have to fear investigation or rational thinking or science, for that matter. I mean, she believed in science for her entire life and built a lot of her ministry on what we might consider rational kinds of ideas. So I think that's a way where these evangelicals, and that's why I think the term the mother of modern evangelicalism is important, because she's doing this in the teens and the 20s, this kind of rethinking about the relationship of Christians to American culture and this sort of things. So she always believed that you have to nurture the life of faith first. I mean, that was the most important thing. Evangelism was number one for her. But she also believed that, you know, you have to serve a blessed and broken world. And so even in those days when she was in Minneapolis with that group of young women, she always emphasized service to others. Now, again, that has to be put in the context of evangelism, because I think her hope always was that people would be brought to Christ. But I mean, they would go to, for example, there were a series of homes at the time for unwed mothers. And so she would have ministry to those women in the Florence Crittenden homes is what they were called. They would do work with underprivileged, underserved kids, underserved populations in Minneapolis, and of course also in the greater LA area. So that was always important too. She also believed that though you had to engage secular culture, you couldn't separate from it. See, I think that's another one of these differences between modern evangelicalism and fundamentalism, especially a particular wing of fundamentalists that believe that you had to have strict separation between the things of the Lord or the things of the kingdom, if you will, and the things of this world. And Mears said, no, we have to thoughtfully engage culture. And that, I think, was really an important part of who she was. She also believed that the importance of including others was paramount. Now, that doesn't mean, I don't mean to imply that any takers were in under her umbrella. But I think if we look at her, especially in the context of her time, her reaching out to folks in other denominations and her intriguing kind of perspective with regard to Roman Catholicism at the time, you know, again, I think she really struggled with the liturgical side of things. I think, again, being raised as a Baptist, and she kind of called herself a kind of a Baptarian often. But the idea that, you know, the liturgical kinds of things, sacramentalism, she wasn't so enamored of those kinds of issues because she saw them as ritual and not life. So we can't certainly say that she was welcoming Roman Catholics in the same sense that we might think about that. That bigger body of Christ today, but she certainly was not the enemy of Roman Catholicism, as so many of those, even the evangelicals, were of the 1940s and 50s. She tried to cast a real wide net. And I think one of the greatest examples of that is she was nominated for an award that was given every year. And again, there are different regions of the country, but this particular organization included Jewish women, Roman Catholic women, and Protestant women. And she was nominated for an award from this group in the 1950s. So I think, again, you get this sense that, well, they must have recognized that she really did have an important contribution to make to the community, and to have women from those three different perspectives supporting her nomination, I think, is pretty significant.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that is very helpful. So Mears, or one of the things I found really fascinating is how Mears developed her pedagogy as a public educator and administrator in Minnesota first, and then transitioned these skills over into the religious realm at her home church when she took over the expanding educational mission there. Now, you note that her class there at First Baptist, it outgrew every room that the church had. So in your research, I guess, what did you find that explained the popularity of her pedagogy? Was this something common that was going on at the time, or was she really an innovator in this realm?
Yeah, I think that's again an excellent question. When I pondered both looking at what happened in Minneapolis at First Baptist, and also, of course, what happened in Southern California, I think what really set her apart was that she was an excellent teacher. I mean, there's no getting around that. I mean, she was able. I mean, the folks that I talked to just said, you know, you just sit under her for 5 minutes, you're going, how did this woman? How does she come up with this stuff? I mean, she's so insightful. Just had such a strong sense of God's presence and God's care. But I think the other thing that she did is that she really could communicate care for the individual. Now, you know, when she, again, that class at that young woman's class in Minneapolis grew to, again, over 400. The one in Southern California at First Press Hollywood actually had an enrollment of over 800. Now, that doesn't mean they all showed up every Sunday, but I mean, these were enrolled members of the class, the college department. But she could, and I talked to more people, said she could just make you feel like you were the most important person in the world as individual. And I think they picked that care up. I think another thing that she did is this woman was a tremendous organizer. She believed very much that once someone comes through the door, you want to make sure that they not only feel welcomed, but that they also have a role to play in the success of the group. And there are countless stories over the years of people that would come in the door to either the college department at First Press Hollywood or the Fidelis class there at First Baptist Minneapolis. And she found a job for them right away. And she made sure that they were welcomed and that they had a role to play. And she always tied the role that each individual played to the success of the class itself. And I think that's really the, you know, those three things, you know, her ability to exposit scripture so clearly and to have examples that just spoke to folks, the ability to make every person feel like they were part of the group, that they were it was a privilege for them to be part of the group. And the group felt that it was a privilege for these visitors to come and be welcomed in, and then to find a place for each of them. To serve. I remember speaking to one individual, and he showed up, went to the college department in Hollywood a few times, and she plugged him in as kind of a social chairman, just like that. Now, you could argue perhaps, well, that could lead to some problems, and it did. I mean, I think I mentioned a few of them in the book, but generally, people knew that she cared about them, and that the role that they played in that class was important for the success of the class. Does that help a little bit?
Absolutely. That is a fascinating account. So Mears, she makes the move to Los Angeles, and I find early 20th century LA to be this fascinating place from a religious perspective, because it was both Tinseltown and it had all of the excesses that we still sort of associate with that culture. But it was also this hothouse of Christian fundamentalism. And you mentioned a figure like Amy Semple McPherson, fighting Bob Schuller was a Southern Methodist fundamentalist across town at the Methodist church there. And then, of course, you had the First Presbyterian Church in Hollywood, which was very theologically conservative. So I guess talk a bit about that context. How do you think it shaped Mears and her specific ministry in that Southern California era?
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, I think that she realized when she went, I picked up in her personal correspondence some sense of trepidation leaving Minneapolis for LA. And I think part of it was that what you say, that LA is kind of a different animal than Minneapolis. It is now, it was then.
Right.
And her concern that will what I did here translate well into Southern California and that cultural context that was growing up in LA at the time. And I think that she very quickly recognized that the basic kinds of approaches that she took, again, expository teaching, caring for individuals, that, you know, that's universal. It doesn't matter, you know, where you live. If you feel cared for, you're going to be part of that group where you feel cared for. I think she also really tried, and again, this is kind of where the big tent idea comes in. She really tried to connect with folks that maybe would have disagreed with her in terms of, for example, you know, her involvement in the co-founding of the Hollywood Christian Group in 1949. There were many evangelicals that really were frustrated with Hollywood and Tinseltown and that whole shtick. She wasn't. She tried to include as many people under that tent as she possibly could. And so I think her involvement with that Hollywood Christian Group for the first 10 years of its life, her willingness to reach out to Amy Semple McPherson, by the folks that I talked to, she and Amy Semple McPherson had a cordial relationship until the death of the latter in the 40s. And again, that's something that many others would say, well, you know, you want to stay clear of someone like that. She Oral Roberts probably prayed for her at least once for her healing of her eyes, which was an affliction she had from a very young age. You know, again, faith healers. I mean, she, one of the local faith healers, opened her home to Mears's college group. And so those kids would go, you know, and have sings or socials at the home of one of the faith healers of the area. So again, I think that the net that she cast was really quite wide. Now, again, I don't want to imply that everybody who claimed to be a believer, was part of that group. But I think her net was a lot wider and her umbrella was a lot larger than a lot of folk, a lot of her contemporaries. I mean, if you see, for example, one of the things that I found just astounding is that she actually would rent films from the L.A. school district. Sex education films. Now, again, granted, sex education films in the 40s and 50s were not nearly as involved as they are today. But I mean, that you would have essentially an evangelical person that is renting these films, showing them in the church, and believing very much that that's where you want to teach students about sexuality in the church. And again, I just think that is phenomenal when you think of the context of evangelicalism or fundamentalism in the 1940s and 50s. I mean, that's just phenomenal to me.
Yeah, it really is remarkable. Now, in the post-World War II years, you note that Mears's reputation, it really went from a kind of local religious celebrity in Los Angeles to a national and even international platform. Talk about some of the opportunities that she had and her influence in transatlantic Protestantism of those decades.
Good question. Yeah. I think her involvement, first of all, I think the founding of the Gospelite Press in the early 30s was a step toward that. Now, it didn't happen overnight, but by the later 40s and the 50s, her materials, her Sunday school materials, were used not just nationally. I mean, there were thousands, and I can't remember what the numbers were. I've got them in the book, but I can't pull them up. But there were thousands of churches in this country using her stuff, but they were also being used internationally. So I think that's one way her reputation got out. Another way was that she traveled a lot. She went at least 10 trips overseas. And what she would do, the first trip she took actually happened before she even moved to L.A. when she went to Europe after the First World War, did a little tour there as a college graduate, university graduate. But she would go overseas and visit a lot of the missionaries that the church had sent out. And so I think that, and then of course those in various areas, various mission areas, they would have conferences or opportunities for her to speak to wider groups of missionaries that weren't just folks that were sent out from First Press Hollywood, but that, you know, were folks that had come from other parts of the country and the world. So I think that's also an important thing. Mm-hmm. By the 1940s, particularly the later 40s, she's really involved in the National Association of Evangelicals. You know, the NAE gets founded in the early 40s, but she's really involved in many kinds of ways in the NAE. She was a member of the Commission on International Relations for most of the 1950s for the NAE. She was also an advisory board member for the World Evangelical Fellowship from 1956 forward. She was also an advisory board member for the Commission on the World Evangelical Fellowship. Oh, I already mentioned that. I'm sorry. but she did these kinds of things as she continued to gain a reputation as a respected Bible teacher and a Christian educator. Mm-hmm. I think the last thing that demonstrates this, and again, I think it's also an example of her kind of forward thinking. Less than 2 years before she died, she founded something called GLINT, which is Gospel Light International. What she realized in her travels is that a lot of the folks, the indigenous populations, needed to be able to be trained so that they could evangelize their own folks. And again, that's pretty progressive in the 1950s and the early 1960s, because again, at that point, the American mission movement or the European mission movement was still fairly strong. But she's saying essentially, yes, that's important, but we need to make sure that we can train these folks to take over, evangelism and service in their own countries. And so Gospel Light International, GLINT, was a kind of an offshoot, in a sense, of the Gospelite Press, that is providing materials in the languages of the indigenous populations, and thereby helping train them toward evangelism and service in their own areas. So I think, again, those are those are areas. She was really involved. Lillian Dixon was a missionary in Taiwan, had a mission emphasis on orphans and dispossessed young people particularly. And Mears really got behind that and helped build the reputation of the what Lillian Dixon was doing. And again, and Lillian Dixon, of course, in response, of course, touted Mears' influence and help in that particular organization. So I think she seems to me to be, again, an individual who is willing to try new things, to see things a little bit differently, a little less Euro or American centric. And I think, again, I don't want to belabor that too much. I mean, I think obviously she still had limitations, and I have a whole chapter on, I think, what some of those limitations were. But by the same token, given the context of the time, I think she was a pretty progressive thinker in many ways, while remaining a very theologically conservative and Christ-centered Christian educator.
Very interesting. Talk about Mears' relationship to Fuller Theological Seminary. Maybe first explain that for listeners who aren't quite as familiar with what Fuller represented, especially when it was founded. Talk about what Fuller is, and then how Mears' life and ministry sort of played into the founding of that particular school at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fuller Seminary was the brainchild of Charles E. Fuller, who was born in Orange County. I know he had a ministry there for a long time, but became very popular on the radio as the leader, he and his wife, of what was called the Old Fashioned Revival Hour. And it was a very, very important radio ministry, not just in Southern California, but it was nationwide. It was quite well known. And in the 40s, Fuller was thinking about, again, the future of Christianity, particularly Orthodox Christianity in the country and the world, and began to think about the possibility of founding a graduate institution that would train folks from an evangelical perspective, again, to serve and to minister to the modern world. And so that's kind of the genesis of Fuller Seminary. He got Harold John Ockenge, who was the leader of one of the largest evangelical churches in Boston, and Park Street Church was what it was called. And he had a tremendous ministry on the East Coast, and Fuller was able to convince him to take the position of president initially for him. So he was the first president of Fuller Seminary and served in that capacity for a few years. He also pulled seminary professors, very prominent seminary professors from other large, well-known seminaries in the Midwest and the East Coast, in the South, and put together again a staff that was again committed to bring this again kind of Mearsian perspective on faith, if you will, in the 20th century to a graduate institution, and so that's the context for the founding of the seminary. And of course, it became the largest evangelical seminary in the country, and today has, I think, at least at its high point, had thousands of folks that were involved in seminary education. Mears got involved a couple of years after the founding because there was from the very beginning, Fuller initially believed, again, the guiding lights of Fuller believed that, again, it's a place for men to train for advanced ministry, and women were essentially helpmeets. Okay, they were the wives, and so right from the beginning there was kind of a wives' fellowship. But some of the women kind of chafed at that and said, "Well, why can't we take seminary classes?" So almost from the very beginning, Fuller had to kind of consider the women, eventually, again, it only took a couple of 3 years. Eventually, Fuller realized, boy, you know, there's a real interest that women have in seminary education. Now, it was not appropriate at that particular point in time for women to ascend to formal ministry. In other words, that to be ordained to the ministry was not something that very many evangelicals at all believed. And of course, Fuller Seminary was in that that same tradition. So they did not really believe that women should come to seminary to become ordained, but they also realized that women had a hunger for advanced education, and also that many women were serving as directors of Christian education or music ministers in churches. And so they developed a program, I think it was called the Bachelor of Sacred Ministry, if I'm remembering correctly, degree for women. And then once that happened, they thought, well, now, wait a second. If we have women in seminary, we probably should have a woman that is actually a member of the faculty. And so they began looking then for a female to serve as the first chair of Christian education. Because, of course, if you're going to have a Bachelor of Sacred Ministry degree, you want to have the possibility of extended study in Christian education, curriculum, theory, that sort of thing. And so that's when they recruited they recruited for this position. And what's so intriguing is that they recruited the same person that had been offered the position of the first chair of Christian education at Wheaton College. They offered that same position to her at Fuller, and she turned them down. And Mears was the other one that was in the running for this. But, you know, unlike this other individual, Mears didn't have any advanced degree at all. I mean, she just had a bachelor's degree from the University of Minnesota in chemistry. And so a lot of the seminarians, and again, this would be Carl F. H. Henry, you know, folks like that, that thought, well, now she doesn't have an advanced degree. Is that going to go over very well? So they offered the position to this other woman, and Mears kind of was in the background, and they were mostly concerned about Mears, not necessarily her degree so much, or lack of degree. They were concerned because of her forceful personality. In fact, I've got some great quotes in the book taken right from the Fuller faculty minutes that talk about the fact that they're afraid that she could take over the faculty. so all these guys would be intimidated by Henrietta Mears. And so rather than, you know, select her initially, they selected this other woman. She turned them down. Then they went back to Mears and she turned them down. So it became a really intriguing study in the kind of late 40s and early 50s there in terms of Fuller Seminary as to what they were looking for and what kind of woman they were looking for. And they believed that Mears was just a little bit too forceful. And then when they finally did offer it to her, she turned it down as she turned down the first chair in Christian education at Wheaton back in 1936.
That is a remarkable story. Now, one of the later chapters in your book you've noted is on paradoxes and limitations. And this one was particularly illuminating for me, I think, because it really brought out the human side of Mears with her weaknesses and contradictions, as we all have. You note she was a humble person, she was spendthrift, but also managed to accumulate a pretty significant fortune and really basked in the Southern California lifestyle, or at least parts of it. She was incredibly successful at growing ministries, but as you just noted, that often came with some pretty exacting standards that could be off-putting for some. I guess the question is, when you finish the book, what's your personal opinion of Mears? Is she someone that you would want teaching your children in Sunday school class?
The questions you're asking are things that I've thought about so much. I think that Mears always knew where she wanted to go, and she also knew how she wanted to get there. And I think one of the things that struck me is I think I probably would have chafed a little bit under her ministry. Not that I wouldn't have appreciated it, but I think that she just had a way, and again, interviewing all these folks that knew her and really loved her, you'd get a sense that, again, she would let you know what you should be doing. and I think one of the things I tried to point out in that chapter is that she would say, on the one hand, that, you know, I want you to be where God wants you to be. And so she would kind of leave it completely open. But then there are these cases where she says, no, I think God wants you here. So it depended on who you were as to how she kind of thought about your future and you know, where you should be and what God wants you to do. I mean, Gary Demarest is such a great example because, again, Gary Demarest was a very prominent Presbyterian pastor, retired a number of years ago now, but he was also involved with, you know, a lot of the ministries of the Presbyterian Church and also other ministries. But Gary Demarest told me that the first time she met him, she looked at him and said, "God wants you in the ministry." Well, he was a civil engineer. I'm not sure he was a civil engineer. I can't remember now. But he was an engineering graduate from University of California, Berkeley, and was working, I think, in Pasadena at the time. And she just said, you know, she met him one time, said, "You need to be in the ministry." And he said, "You've got to be kidding me." Well, he ended up in the ministry. And you hear these stories again and again and again. And so on the one hand, I'm just astounded that she had that kind of ability to show folks kind of where they could be used by God. On the other hand, I'm not sure I would take too well to someone that told me that this is what God wants me to do. You know, I'm more of a person that kind of responds to the subtle kind of, "Have you thought about this, Arlen? Or have you thought about that?" I think Mears came right down and kind of hit you right between the eyes if you were one of those people that she felt that way about. Because there were plenty of folks where she didn't necessarily say that this is where you need to be, but she would guide, that she would encourage them to seek God's direction. So it just depended on who you were, whether you got the kind of the frontal approach or the more subtle approach. And if she gave me the subtle approach, I think we'd get along fine. If she was more kind of right in my face, I'm not sure. I might have a little trouble with that.
Understood. Well, Dr. Migliazzo, thank you so much for the time that you've given us today, and especially for writing this fantastic and much needed biography. Before we go, do you have any other projects that you're working on right now? Anything we can look forward to?
Oh, thanks. Well, I'm working on a book of short essays, but that's kind of just in the very formative stage at this particular point. So this was kind of my last big project as a historian. I'm still kind of got my fingers in some things, but nothing like this. I mean, this is really, when this book was published, it was really, there was a sigh of kind of relief. And the intriguing thing for me that I didn't even realize when I began this is how connected I was to her. And I never even realized it before this. As I said, I grew up in Southern California. My home church was St. John's United Presbyterian Church in Compton, California. And I didn't even know it at the time, but my home church pastor there, Bruce Curley, one of our assistant ministers, Ted Nissen, the Christian education director, Norm Wright, were all Mears guys.
Wow.
And I had no idea of that growing up. I grew up on gospel-like Sunday school material. And again, as I mentioned, when I did youth work in my early and mid-20s and came to Washington, I sat under the ministry of one of her other guys that had been trained by one of her disciples. So I was kind of, in a sense, kind of a third generation Mearsian without even really knowing it. And that's one of the most intriguing things to me about this whole process is it kind of brings my life, my professional life in Washington State together with my kind of formative years in LA in ways that I never would have expected that there would be that kind of connection.
Huh. Well, it is a fascinating story that you've told in the book, and is one that I would encourage anyone interested in the study of evangelicalism in America to make sure they pick up. It is really a great book. Dr. Arlen Migliazzo is the author of Mother of Modern Evangelicalism, The Life and Legacy of Henrietta Mears. It is available now from Eerdmans Publishing Company and is, as I've said, just a fantastic addition to the religious biography series. Dr. Migliazzo, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lane.
And thank you for listening to New Books in History. Make sure to subscribe to our channel wherever you get your podcast to keep up with the latest and the best books that are out there right now. Thanks for listening and be well.